Hey everybody, welcome to episode 36 of Bedroom Beethoven's, the podcast where I grab producers by the shoulders and I hoist them up off cliff edges like Simba so you can take a good look at them. These are conversations with makers of new sounds, and my guest this week is none other than the great and powerful K. Murdoch, who was born and raised in D.C. and has worked with Grammy-nominated acts. And I only have 45 minutes to cover so much ground, everything from when he was raised during the wilting years of hip-hop and how he developed his love of music at an early age through exposure from older family members. Y'all, when he borrowed the cassettes of two of collective landmark groups, De La Soul and A Tribe Called Quest in the early 1990s, things forever changed. Hell, he's even got the tattoo on his right arm to prove it. Hey, this podcast is brought to you by no one. I keep it ad-free for your pleasure, so please head on over to patreon.com/bedroombeethovens and you can get some cool merch, sticker packs, access to early shows. Costs you as little as $2, and it keeps the ship afloat. Bedroombeethovens.com is the site, the hub, the nucleus. It's got the links to Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, no Facebook, because Facebook sucks, and that's just keeping it real. All right, guys, let's get into it. I am your host, Cello, and the Lamont Landers Band will let you know what podcast you're tuned into.
It's the Bedroom Beethoven Podcast.
I had a mental foot and mouth moment because when I met you, I didn't know your work ahead of time. Mega Ran was like, "Hey, you got to connect with this dude," and then we talk, and I'm like, "Oh, I remember the Scenic Route cover art. I remember bumping Starlight in my college dorm room, and it was very weird that I was bumping Panacea for over a decade, and then I find out it was you. So it was very surreal for me."
Oh, that's man, that's awesome. You know, I've been the last few weeks, like, had a lot of people hit me up who were just like, "Yo, your music got me through some tough times back 10 years ago or 5 years ago." So I never know when you're making this stuff, like, the impact it's going to have. It's not necessarily why I do it. But it's so cool to hear, like, people just be like, you know, "Oh, you're that K. Murdoch," or like, "You know, your music helped me. Your music was my panacea." I was like, "Oh shit, I guess that's kind of what the aim was," indirectly, you know?
Yeah, Ink Is My Drink dropped this week, 13 years ago, I think October the 3rd. It was this week.
Look, I need to do Throwback Thursday. I'm so bad with social media, man. That's something I need to get better at. But at the same time, like, it just, you know, if I have the ability to be social and do that stuff or create, I'm going to always lean towards creation and look into hiring someone to do.
I'm just glad we had this opportunity to connect at this point in our lives, because now we get to meet as husbands and fathers, and even at your age, I'm seeing a renewed boost of interest and motivation. Like, you're back in the studios on Saturdays, which, you know, you probably couldn't do when you had, you know, little tiny kids and all that.
Nah, man, and it's been cool. Like, it came through. I'm currently getting my master's in audio technology at American University in Washington, D.C. And I happen to go in this Saturday and help out another guy who's a way younger, because I'm definitely one of the older students there, if not the oldest in the program right now. And he had no experience with Pro Tools or studio recording. I was like, "Dude, this is like been such a big part of my life since I left undergraduate, you know, school in 2001. So I basically just went in to mentor and like oversee a session and a system with like recording some drums and bass. And it felt good. It definitely brought me back to, like I posted with recording Raw Poetic. The only thing that's changed is the technology and the fact you know, it's not Raw Poetic in the studio with me right now. It's, you know, it's young kid. Shout out to Ryan. So, yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, if there are any younger listeners listening, let me tell you, applaud this man, because the older you get, the less you want to do shit like that. Going back to school in your late 30s, early 40s, or finding a new sound to suit you, it's hard. And that's why you see mainstream rappers making the same music they make at 50 than they do at 20.
Yeah.
Shit's hard.
Yeah, man. Yeah. And that was always my fear, and still is. Like, I just don't want to ever be, you know, I'm always about being progressive and evolving and stuff. So if I find myself, that's probably why I try to change up my sound. And the Panacea stuff was such a good example, because I felt like the albums had a through line, and the consistents were the fact that it was me and Raw Poetic. But sonically, I tried. I can't say I always pulled it off successfully, but I didn't want any of our records to sound the same. So from Thinking Back, Looking Forward, all the way to the Scenic Route, 12-step program, which was our last project almost 10 years ago, it was just different. And I still hold out hope that me and Raw Poetic can do one. I just want to do one more album to kind of close the chapter, possibly, or, you know, because we both kind of segued into other things. But like, I still, to this day, that's still the best music I make. And I, you know, getting back to the idea I said of not being static and always evolving, man, Raw Poetic Jason, his real name, he always pushed me, man, because even the way we linked, the first record we did was a tried and true case of that, because I gave him a beat tape of 10 tracks, and tracks 1 through 9 were just like the typical boom bap, you know, joints that sound like some wannabe Dilla and Tribe stuff. And then track 10 happened to be something I like was kind of just so out, like left field. And of all the beats, he was like, yo, that last joint on there is like, let's work with that. And that just kind of set it off. And it wound up being the first song we ever recorded, called Bird Feather, back in 2003. So it's crazy. Just, you know, since then, like, anytime I get something different, I know Jason or Raw Poetic is going to be the one I like pitch it to first, because that dude just loves to be taken out his comfort zone, and sonically, so do I.
Well, Marley Marl said that about you guys back in the day, because you were getting some good looks, especially, I think it was Damu. What was missing from the game was soul, and you guys were very young cats that were big into soul. I mean, where does that start? Were your parents in the house listening to Bill Withers or the Manhattans, or is this just a DMV thing?
You know, like, I grew up around, my uncle was like a pretty famous local radio disc jockey. He actually created the format that is known as the Quiet Storm. Like, so I grew up like listening to a lot of like kind of music from that vein, like a lot of it could be Anita Baker, Luther Vandross, Phyllis Hyman. That stuff was playing, because every night in my house, at 7 o'clock, we turned on the radio and I could hear my uncle doing the Quiet Storm, starting off with the Smokey Robinson track, Soft and Warm. Soft and Warm. A Quiet Storm.
Quiet as when flowers talk at break.
So that kind of vein of soul music was kind of my bag. So I grew up on a lot of that. My dad thought he was probably like the lost member from the Shy Lights. He would always be singing like that high, you know, like the high key, kind of like a falsetto. He couldn't sing though, so, and neither can I. So,
you short circuit all my nerves, promising electric things. You touch me and suddenly.
Funny that I would always laugh and clown him, but I'm that way now. My daughters are like, Daddy, please stop. Like, like, just stick to the beats. But yeah, I just grew up around a lot of that music. But I can vividly remember driving around in the 80s. My mom had like 2 cassette tapes in heavy rotation. They were always Anita Baker's Rapture, and it was always a 3. I take it back. And second would be, it was a 2-disc retrospective, like greatest hits of Luther Vandross, and the third would be Jeffrey Osborne, which is so random, but like that kind of stuff was the stuff I'm like really into. So I just grew up into that. And then when it wasn't until I, when I got to XM Radio in 2001 and started working there, and I had basically access to like music libraries that were just beyond the typical jazz and soul. Cause at XM, you had all these channels from rock, jazz, country, pop. And, you know, I was around people who listened to stuff other than that. So they would be hipping me to stuff and I'd be like, yo, I recognize that sample, or I know that artist from this record. So I still working there, and as my day job, kind of expanded my palette as far as the stuff I wanted to sample, which you could hear reflected because in the Panacea stuff, and I'm sorry if this is like a super long answer, but I told you I'm super long winded. But the, if you listen to, for instance, the Scenic Route compared to Ink Is My Drink, Ink Is My Drink hat was more like some soul, and I think there was some folks, some Joan Baez and different people you heard on there, whereas like the Scenic, the Scenic Route was like Electric Lights Orchestra, a lot of Vangelis, a lot of John Anderson and Yes type stuff. I was really into prog rock. So every album to me, for especially for Panacea, I mentioned this earlier, it almost had a different sound based on who I was listening to.
When the Panacea stuff came out around 2006, 2007, mm-hmm. I know it was mainly you and Damu the Fudge Monk. He was kind of like the ninth wonder to the little brother. But around that same time, he came out with Travel at Your Own Pace, the Y Society. Right. Was there any friction between you guys when that album came out?
Oh, no. Damu's my dude, man. I mean, Damu's like, I've known Damu since he was 16. Like, Damu is 5 years younger than me. He's the same age as my little brother. And for a long time, he was probably closer than my real blood brother, or one of my blood brothers, just because I would see him all the time. So when I worked at XM Radio, a lot of stuff flows through XM Radio, or now Sirius XM Radio. So I was working there. A lot of people might not know this. I was working there. I got my undergraduate bachelor's degree in radio or audio production. And when I graduated from Howard University, I wound up taking a job. I was interning at a bunch of places in DC, and XM Radio, which I've been reading about in these trade magazines about like satellite radio, the radio of the future. I got a job there first as a production assistant, and then showing my chops in like audio editing and sound design, they hired me. I became the youngest production director there, which basically means I would produce a lot of the stuff that you would hear that's not the song. So like the artist drops, the promos, the show intros, that kind of stuff. And even like taking interviews and basically doing podcasts before podcasts was a thing, as far as like long form narrative storytelling. So when I was there, Damu was a local DC student at a school there, and I remember he came by one day on a tour with some other high school students, and he stuck around. Like literally everyone else left my room and he stuck around, and he was like, yo, I make beats, which at that time I was like, yo, everyone makes beats. But when he literally gave me a cassette tape, I listened to it and I was like, this dude is dope. And I come to find out the dude does graffiti. He raps secretly. He's a hell of a DJ, and he kind of became like the Panacea's DJ, like the third member, the Jirobi of the crew. So Panacea was always me on the beats. I did all the beats, draw poetic rapping. And then anytime on all our albums, when you heard a cut, it was Damu. That's why Damu's in the Starlight video. He's in the Pop Set video, because I always kind of made him, or in my mind, he was like a member of the group. And at the same time, like concurrently with all that stuff going on, he was forming with Insight, Y Society. And then he went on to form his own imprint with Redefinition Records. And it's crazy how that comes full circle, because now Raw Poetic is doing a lot of music with Damu. And truth be told, Damu and Raw Poetic knew each other before I knew Raw Poetic. So it's like Inception, man. It's so many layers. Like, but it's cool just to see people grow and people still doing it. And just making music now, like the stuff we make now versus then, is just, you know, apples and oranges, but it's just still very cool.
Well, let's talk about that. Let's take Rob P, for example. You know, he's in the studio to this day. Yes. He's rubbing shoulders with legends. He's still putting out music 15 plus years in the game. However, he's got less than 1,000 followers on social media. Do you view the whole Panacea Rockets Records thing as just a tragedy? Could y'all have been marketed better? Could you have had more autonomy? You know,
That's a good question, man. I mean, speaking for Jason, I've known Jason now for over 15 years. I know he's not really all about that. Like we've talked about it for ourselves individually, because he would come to me and be like, yo, you know, can you hit me? Like, I remember telling him about Bandcamp like 10 years ago. I was like, yo, you should look into Bandcamp for the stuff you're doing solo wise and even your other group, which I was helping him out with at one point, called Restoring Poetry and Music. But he just rather create. I mean, that's why he puts out like albums all the time. And I'm always like, Jason, you didn't even like really promote this, but to the people who are big fans, they're going to find this stuff. And that's not really why he does it. He just does it because he likes to create. And I've at the heart of it, hearing him talk about it and seeing that he can still do it amidst all the stuff that he's juggling, it's inspiring to me.
But you know what, though? Well, in regards to Ruckus, though, everybody thought they were horrible business people except for Talib Kweli. And why is that? Why is that? Because they pushed them.
They pushed them. Yeah. That's so funny. I said that all the time, because when I was working at XM, like post, you know, or like around the time of Panacea, I happened to interview, I was doing a hip hop show. And so people like Evil D and Mr. Walt from the Beat Miners would come through. DJ Spinner would come through. Pharoah Monch. All these people who were on Ruckus didn't have really anything good to say. But the one person who did, and we interviewed him like four times on the show I was doing on XM, Talib Kweli, I was like, he was the only cat that Ruckus really pushed to this day. And I found this out like by casually listening to his podcast, The People's Platform. On a few episodes, he always is like shouting out. He's like, shout out to Jared in the building. Jared Meyer is one of the guys, the two main guys who started Ruckus.
The MySpace.
Yeah. Yes.
And he discovered you guys on MySpace, right?
Yep. So the story goes, there was another group called Glow in the Dark Records based out of LA. They were like a small imprint from, they were also in a group themselves called Time Machine. And so shout out to Jay Sonic. He found us, and he was talking to Jared from Ruckus at the time, and Jared was like, yo, these guys, Panacea, you guys got swooped up. We want to work out a situation because we really like their sound and what they're about, and I feel like this new wave of Ruckus, they can help kickstart it along with the Kids in the Hall, Knowledge and Double O, and the Percussions. And so the main three new artists to relaunch Ruckus in 2006 was us, Kids in the Hall, and the Percussions. And I think we're the only ones that put out two albums on the new wave of Ruckus, because Percussions did their album and Knowledge and Double O did their album, and that was a wrap. Like, I think they did like some solo stuff with Guru, like one of his Jazzmatized records when he was working with the quote unquote the super producer. What was the guy's name, man? Because he was kind of like not cool, man. It wasn't Premier he was with. It was this guy. Oh, man, his name escapes me at the time. But if you just Solar, that's his name. Solar, super producer Solar is what he called himself. And, you know, that dude, from what I know of him.
I never even heard of him.
Yeah, it's an interesting story. Like that whole, because he was there. He was like an executive of Guru's estate, like. I mean, it's crazy the levels of just like what people were even insinuating as far as their relationship and stuff. And then people felt like, yo, Premier, people, when you think about Guru, you think about Gangsta and Premier. But at that time, I remember interviewing Guru, and Guru didn't even want to talk about Premier, because he was like, that's the past. I'm with Solar right now. We're doing this new Jazzmatized and blah, blah, blah.
So you think he would be on board with this new music coming out that DJ Premier is trying to push the new Guru album?
It's hard to say, man.
Yikes.
Because I don't know, man. I know, like, because at first I saw the posting was like Premier releases new Gangsta album, then it was like a tease for that it could be one of more songs to come. But now I've been seeing it kind of walk back a little bit. Like, I did this song, I know Guru was a fan at that time of like Upstart cats like J. Cole, because I think J. Cole was kind of bubbling and starting to come up right when Guru passed, right?
Like friends that'll kill for you, went up in a jewelry store, burglary, steal for you, bill with you, split the diamond in two, ice blue. Twice you try to disrespect our kinship, I don't like you. And now you axed out the fam, but I'm cashing checks with Premier on his jam. Diamonds are
for- I don't know. He's not alive, so it's hard to even speak for him, but I feel like Premier knows him longer and better than most people. So I would think that he would, you know, as his man, he would know better, you know. So I'm going to defer to Guru, Premier on that.
Yeah, did we? I have to be fixated on Rockets just a little bit more because I don't think people understand the tragedy. Like, you had Eminem that was on Sound Bombing 2, and then he made it evident that he's pretty salty about the whole thing on that Don't Front track. But, man, do you realize that if you were signed to them 5 years prior, what a legend? Of the Lyricist Lounge, did you look at the producer credits? You had Pete Rock, High Tech, LP, De La Soul, Q-Tip, Diamond D. That shit would have made three Mercedes-Benz just magically appear in their driveway.
Oh, come on. Yeah. Dude, I know. You know, it's funny you mentioned Q-Tip too amidst the rundown of like the people on that album because, you know, in full transparency, I have no reason. I don't hate it. Like, I mean, that time it was 13 years ago. But like Jared, I remember I even have the recording still, the voicemail when Jared called me one time. He's like, "Hey, K Murdoch, why aren't you picking up the phone, man? We're trying to make you a star. You're already acting like a big star." And I was like, it wasn't that. I was like literally at work and I work in a studio like producing. So, you know, like etiquette is that you can't be stopping in the middle of the session and dude's doing a take and I'm on the phone. So I had to like, you know, text or call back at my own convenience. So he's just an interesting dude. But like one of the promises he had when we were doing the second album, he was like, "Yo, we're going to send you guys to Europe. We're going to push Scenic Route out there," because we had a real big buzz in Europe at the time. And actually, the Scenic Route got album of the year, beating out Ghostface, Kanye, all its Quali's albums, and like what would be the equivalent of The Source in Europe. So we had a huge like following in Europe, like, so and he mentioned, he was like, "Yo, I'm also gonna get you have you work with Q-Tip." I was like, "You gotta be kidding me." So I'm like hearing all this stuff, and of course, just, you know, I'm gassed up and excited because anyone who knows me knows I'm a huge Tribe Called Quest fan. Like, shoot, I got the freaking tattoo of Midnight Marauders on my right forearm. In another time, maybe 5 years prior, that would have been really like, I feel like it would have been great. But I mean, at that point, 5 years prior, in 2001, I was just starting to make music really seriously. And I was kind of just doing my thing on the DC scene. And I really wasn't even doing hip hop. I was doing more like progressive soul with like this guy, Wes Felton and Raheem Devon. So at the time, and then I met Raw Poetic in 2003. And, you know, the rest is history.
Yeah, I mean, same with Lyricist Lounge 2. You had Alchemist, Eric Sermon, Madlib, Premier, Dilla. And it was just like, oh, in another timeline, like K Murdoch would have been on that.
Yeah,
and you
know what?
It's like you're very successful. You were always very successful, even with Mega Ran, with Panacea. But you had a shot at top 40 rap, like Jay-Z rap. And they this is crazy for me because they said, like, without sugarcoating it, like, you know, this sucks. Which Dame Dash, say what you will about him, but his opinion is subjective. It's all opinions are subjective. So how can you be successful on a certain level, but then they say you suck when you're trying to elevate yourself on a mainstream level? What's the difference? Because Evidence made it onto a Rockefeller project, and right, he's like Mr. Underground, Mr. Indie Hip Hop.
Because of my connection at that time at XM Radio, Jay-Z was taking beat submissions for the Black Album, and I made this beat. I have to send it to you, man, that I wound up giving to another artist eventually after the story I'm about to tell you. But I made this beat, and the beat, I found a sample, and it sounded like the sample, it was really saying over, but the beat was really, to me, it sounded like it was saying hova, and it was like very big and triumphant, like not necessarily on a Diplomat's level, but just like, this would be a joint to open or close the album. So I thought I was in there, and like, so I burned the joint down, because of course we weren't sending MP3s like in 2001 or 2, and or I wasn't, at least I was still making beat CDs, right? I gave it to my connect to take to Dame Dash when she went up to New York, and it's funny because the whole weekend I didn't want to pester her. Like, what was the feedback? Because usually Dame like will be straight up with you. And when she got back to me, like, I finally saw her. So I gave her the BCD on, like, a Thursday. She went up to New York to meet with Dame Dash over the weekend. And so when I finally saw her on, like, Monday or Tuesday, she was like, yeah, I was kind of, like, holding off on giving you the feedback. But Dame basically was like, tell your man not to quit his day job. Not to quit his day job. And I was like, yo, like, I mean, you want to talk about Mortal Kombat fatalities, straight ripped the heart out, stomped it out like Kano. But I'm glad I never let that. I just, you know, the funny thing was, I mean, not to be on some karma's a bitch shit, but a few months later, Dame and Jay-Z broke up. So I was like, fuck, like, joke's on you, karma's a bitch.
And it's bullshit that they even opened that door, though, saying that, hey, we're willing to listen to anything. Any promising producer has a shot. Because when the Black Album came out, who the fuck was on there? It was Kanye West, Pharrell, DJ Quick, Timbaland, Eminem, Rick. There was no Kyles from DC on there. It was a setup. It was a setup, man.
I think this is like a story that they said J Dilla has submitted tracks, and he didn't even get picked. So I was like, I don't feel so bad. I mean, shit. You know? It just wasn't meant to be, and maybe I wasn't ready, and so when, you know, Fame kind of came via the Panacea thing, we got signed and had a little bit of an advance and a little bit of notoriety, like going to places like New York and CMJ to perform, like stuff I just never foresaw happening. I definitely, you know, took it in stride, man. And, you know, here we are 13 years later, I get to talk about it to you, you know, so it's kind of cool.
You also had interactions with Quincy. Do you get the, hello, Kyle, I'm Quincy, pleasure? Or do you get the, I fucked the president's daughter, Michael Jackson stole Billie Jean, rock ain't nothing but a white version of rhythm and blues. You know, what version did you get? The crazy, eccentric Quincy or the very stoic, professional Quincy?
To me, Quincy's the GOAT. He still is, you know? And it's so cool that to see, I met him over 10 years ago, right when he was turning 75, and here he is, 85, and he's still like, he's still Quincy. And anyone who knows him or even has seen his doc can kind of get what I'm saying by that. He's just like very unapologetically him. And he's just, the one thing I can take away, you know, they always say, be careful about meeting your heroes. He didn't disappoint in the sense of like, he was a very humble. He just made you feel like you're the star. He was really engaging. I remember the first thing he asked me when I met him was, he's like, what's your gumbo? And I'm like, what's my gumbo? Like, I don't even cook. Like, what are you talking about? He's like, no. Like, what's your ethnicity? Like, cause you obviously, you look like you got a lot of things going on. This is pre-ancestry.com. But he was like, I'm just looking at you, I can just tell there's a lot of stuff mixed in you. And I was like, yeah, I'm doing that. You know, I got this and some Native American, Black and Irish. And he was like, wow, that's like cool. And he was like, yeah, I got to keep you away from my girls. And I was like, my girls? Like, hold on. Like, what are you talking about? Then he proceeds to...
A young Rashida.
No, not even his daughters. But he... Quincy Jones, like, he had some young girlfriends, like some girls on the rotation at the time. So he was talking about them. And I was like, wow, like, trust me, like, they going to look at my wallet and look at yours and they're not going to roll with me. Like, you know what I mean? Strictly, I mean, to this day, like, one of the highlights of my life, man.
I have a Quincy Jones story.
Okay.
All right, so when Jamie Foxx was getting really big with the movie Ray, he was going hard. You know, he was drinking, he was popping ecstasy, he was smoking weed. He went to the Golden Globes, fucked up, and he was walking the red carpet, and he gets a call. And on the other end of the phone, it says, hi, Jamie Foxx. And he goes, who's this? And this is Oprah. You're blowing it, Jamie Foxx, you're blowing it. And he goes, well, what do you mean? And she goes, she said, all of this gallivanting, all this kind of shit, that's not what you want to do. I want to take you somewhere that'll make you understand the significance of what you're doing. And she takes him to Quincy Jones's house. She takes him there, and there are all these old Black actors from the 60s and the 70s, and they wanted to wish him luck and tell him not to blow it. It was like an intervention. And they brought in Sidney Poitier on his birthday, and he was there in a tux. And they made him understand the significance of what he was doing. Like Quincy Jones, Oprah, like when Chris Brown beat up Rihanna, Black and Blue, Tyler Perry called Chris Brown. And it's like there's a league of successful Black people who keep the lower tiers in line. It's like a real life Black Justice League. It's crazy to me. I lose sleep over this.
Wow. I did not know that. I know one thing that was, speaking of Oprah and Quincy, during my tour of Quincy Jones' house, he showed me that Oprah has her own like built-in apartment in his house. Like Oprah, whenever she wants to come, can just come to this place, and it's literally like an apartment built into his house. And he toured us through. He's like, "Yeah, this is the bath." The bath was like, I mean, this is like 2005 or 2006. So it's like the bath has a TV, so she could be laying in the bubble bath looking at TV. The TV's embedded in the wall. It has its own like suite, its own amenities and everything, literally built into his friggin' house. I mean, he's like, "Oprah's my girl, so if she ever needs to get away, this is like her Airbnb." I was like, "You have to be shitting me!" Like, I was like, "This is how y'all live, huh?"
Well, when they say don't meet your heroes, it doesn't always go well. I want to know what a young Laura Jamar was like, because 50 Cent just told him he was a bum.
Right.
Just said that he's not Grand Pooba. He's going around saying female rappers are whack and Eminem make the king of hip hop because he's white. It's just a downward spiral. In fact, he said that there's gatekeepers in hip hop. He said, you know, like, fuck Old Town Road. Yep. It's whack. Oh. But at the same time, it's a country song, because if we call Post Malone hip hop, we let this white guy in, but the country people don't want to let black people in. And like, it's just like, why you got to make it about that? What was touring? Was he like the same guy back in the early 2000s?
Nah, I mean, I'm going to keep it 100. I'm going to keep it 1,000. Let me just say this, man. Like, one, again, I'll preface this by saying I'm appreciative of the opportunity. Like, it is super cool to be like on my first major, like, you know, in a domestic tour, we got to open for a Brand Nubian. But I will say that the Brand Nubian that was there was definitely a shell of his former self. Not just because, I mean, if you think about the core of Brand Nubian, it was always really four. It was Brand Pooba, Sadat X, Lil Jamar, Alamo, DJ Alamo. And so Alamo and Sadat, and excuse me, Pooba weren't there. So it was just at this time, this iteration of it, it was just Lil Jamar and Sadat X. And Sadat X was like doing the show, as I found out later. He was really just doing the show because he was trying to squirrel away some money before he was getting ready to go to jail. But Lil Jamar, I just thought it was the thing that was so interesting about him is that at the time he had a solo album called the 5% album or something.
From Brooklyn, will you raise your hand?
You know, and they've always been on that wave, like about the 5% nation and women is earth and man is God and all that stuff, which, you know, if anyone listens to Wu-Tang, you hear a lot of that. A lot of the stuff he was doing off stage, to me, contradicted a lot of the stuff he said in his lyrics. And I just, that kind of rubbed me the wrong way.
General Monk staff. Run devils across the desert 2,200 miles. And make them walk every step of the way. Strip them down. Take everything away. Send them to the mountainous cave. 2,000 years alone stage.
And I remember one particular show. In the haste to get out of there after the show, they performed, or he performed, Lil Jamar like left a box of like a few boxes of his CDs and stuff, and like merch stuff related stuff. And I was like, wow, man, like I know I would never leave a box even of 25 CDs, because you know, do the math, 25 times 10, that'd be $250 I'm leaving at this point. Because what our guarantees of getting paid were so low, we had to basically sell merch. And the merch that we sold as Panacea, we had to report back to Raucous and Sony because they paid for us to have that merch. So it's like, you know, we had to pay it back before we could, you know, get into black and then start profiting. We were just kind of not very happy with the way things were going with touring with Brand Nubian at the time. And I remember we had a really big conversation like, do we leave this box, all these boxes of merch for Lord Jamar and kind of, you know, which he won't have to sell at the shows afterwards. Or since we have a van, can we just throw it in the van and give it to him at the next venue? And, you know, we did the right, what we thought at the time was the right thing. We put the shit in our van and we gave it to him. I think the next show was in Colorado and we gave it to him and it was like, we thought it would get better. And he was like, thanks guys, I appreciate it. But I mean, really, you know, we rarely talked to those dudes during that like run, which is like a 2.5 week run, but we rarely even talked to those dudes. And I was like, this is how we going to set off the fucking, this is the first night of a 2.5 week run. All like from, we went, was it San Francisco all the way down to the border of Mexicali, of Mexico and California. and we had to do like, this is how it's going to be. I was like, fuck no. I mean, we did it because at this point I had taken off a month from work. The guys that were all in, we rented the tour van. I mean, it was just not a good way to start a tour. And I'm glad I can talk about it and kind of laugh about it now, 13 years later. But man, when we were in it, it was depressing, man, to like drive to these cities and know that me and Raw Poetic is Panacea. We had a band with us. So a lot of times the cut, any little cut that we would get, and it wasn't much, we would obviously defer and give to the guys who were the musicians performing our music. Not only because they were the ones really making the show, but also because they're friends and we know they came out on our name. So we had to do them right. But it was tough, man. We definitely finished that tour in the red, man. Like in the real red, if you know what I mean, as far as like finances.
Well, let's fast forward a little bit to happier times, because for the last couple of years you've been doing the video game stuff. For people that aren't hip to that, I want people to understand the weird psychology it takes to be successful, because I'm talking, you could go to the hardest guy on your block. You could find the blackest, thugged out, the guy whose slab has the biggest rims type dude, and you could play him Chun-Li's theme music and he'll love it. But if I say the same composer of Street Fighter 2 also did the soundtracks to Kingdom Hearts, Parasite Eve, Legend of Mana, you can't say, oh, the soundtrack to Super Mario RPG slaps, man. There's this stigma where you have to, like, you know, Final Fantasy VII is like one of the biggest video games ever and the soundtrack's great, but you still kind of have to pull the drapes closed and you can't really celebrate that out in the streets too much.
Oh, you can't roll around the hood blasting, like, you know, Shimmer's theme or or like Costa del Sol theme, like in the summertime. It doesn't slap like Summertime by Jazzy Jeff and Fresh Prince. You know, it's just not the same.
So was that a concern when you and like Mega Ran dipped your toe in the pond? Like, how are we going to be socially accepted and make quality music?
You know, I don't know. I think it was after the fact that after we put out the album that we did Forever Famicom and really started working together that I kind of was like, okay, what are my friends over in the other room going to think? But then again, the more I thought about it, I was like, dude, anyone who remembers Panacea, I used to run our MySpace page. You know, on MySpace, you could go to a person's page and they would have like a quote at the top before their name. And the Panacea, I guess our tagline was like, I still vividly remember writing this. It was when Final Fantasy meets A Tribe Called Quest. And then it was like Panacea and then like our music player on our MySpace page. But I was like, yo, that's really our influence, because even Raw Poetic, where he's a gamer too. I remember many times like we play games and not just Madden. We're very competitive and he used to whoop my ass. I, except for Madden, I used to get him, I feel like. I had always kind of wanted to do, like take video games and I call them flip them or like, you know, produce them the same way that I'm sampling from a jazz or soul record. I'm just sampling from a video game score, putting my take on it and just infusing it with hip hop. So a lot of people cite Forever Famicom as that album that kind of bridged hip hop heads and gamers but I'm like, yo, anyone in our age range, I'm 40 years old, would know like that I can easily remember almost every game I played it being a hip hop song. So I can remember playing this game Chrono Trigger, but the music I was listening to aside from the Chrono Trigger soundtrack, I'm listening to Mobb Deep, The Infamous, you know, which is like a very interesting juxtaposition. It was literally like Samurai Champloo before Samurai Champloo, like in the idea of this cultural mixing, like the West versus the West and the East, that people were like, hold up, are you quote unquote nerdcore now? And I'm like, oh, first off, I cringe at that term, but I get it. So people need to have a term to categorize shit in their iTunes or Spotify. So
did you hear my interview with Mega Ran? I told him I hated nerdcore. I hate that the name of the genre.
Yeah, actually, after I heard your interview with Mega Ran, I was like, I hit him up. I was like, dude, you got to get that with Beethoven. It's like ASAP. And he was working on it, but because I was like, yo, Cello, you know, he knows his shit. And I love, I feel like it's not so much an interview, but just a conversation.
Well, that's my biggest problem is one of the greatest strengths of the podcast as well, is the people that know Kay Murdoch and Mega Ran of the last 10 years. They're coming up to you like, oh, I really love Pokemon and I really love video games and I love what you guys are doing. but nobody's, I feel like there's a very small piece of the pie that knows about Kool-Aid, knows about Prince Paul, that knows about KRS-One, and understands video games, understands your love of the craft, and it goes so deep as it does. And I feel like that's an issue. I feel like more people need to know, like, hey, if you're a fan of Trife Dog, you need to be a fan of K. Murdoch. You need to understand what he's doing in this game.
You know, I tell people all the time, I don't know who's listening. So it's always like a treat when people are like, yo, I was saying this to you before we started, like how just people are like, yo, I've been listening to you for the last 10 years. Like, your music helped me get through this situation. I mean, I've had some people disclose some really personal stuff, like as far as like your music helped me deal with loss and your music helped me deal with, you know, I just like listening to your music puts me back into a memory, which is awesome. Like, because for me, music does that too. Like, I can, whenever I hear D'Angelo Brown Sugar, or whenever I hear Mobb Deep the Infamous, I can remember summer of 95 being in my room listening to the local hip hop radio station that was an AM signal. And I always had the buzz in the back, but because it was hip hop, I'm like, I'm listening through it. Meanwhile, I'm playing Chrono Trigger and Shining Force. Like, I'm playing RPGs that I would never tell my dudes in the hood that I'm playing, because if they ask me, I'm like, yo, of course I played the new NBA Blitz. And I did play those games too, but usually when I'm in the house during the summer, I'm playing a good Japanese role-playing game, you know, just to keep it, you know, keep it real, you know what I mean? And it's just that stuff that I couldn't really admit. So meeting Raheem, X amount of years later, I feel like Raheem is almost like a cousin of mine. We both found like we have a lot of family centralized to the same part of South Carolina. We're literally peers, and not only just age, but a lot of the way we were as far as growing up being hip hop heads and also trying to balance and secretly be gamers too when it wasn't cool to be a gamer or cool to be a nerd.
Because this game's so difficult, it makes me want to cuss. I feel like I'm getting ridiculed by scores of enemies who literally respawn every second. You kidding me? I'm riddling these cats with shots and it ain't phasing them or making them retreat. Man, they think I'm trying to play with them. I made it this far on my own, but now I hit a wall. Hurting ain't no fun unless the homies get involved, getting all frustrated. I hate it, I'm jaded, I want a ticket out, power off, never again play it, I'm faded, should have been in bed hours ago, I called you.
And I love how he's now at this age, like, talking about that and making it cool so that people our age can not feel bad or feel like that was some kind of tragic or secret of past, but also for the new kids coming up, say, yo, like, give them some history and also be like, yo, it's cool, it's okay, like, to be that way, like, nerds run the world, and that shit is damn sure true, man.
Like, rap and video game composition, I mean, you could say all rap is just four bar loops, but the ear has to have the melody groomed for it. You have to keep the ear candy going because the mind turns off when the music doesn't change. Music is strange that way. So, like, I just got my Switch Lite. I revisited Super Mario World for the first time in 15 years, 20 years. Wait, no. 25 years, 26 years. And the last boss is Bowser. The final boss surprised me because the boss music is on a 20-second loop. And since it's for arcade or it's a short playthrough, you can get away with that. But when it comes to JRPGs that you're playing, you're going to hear shit hours and hours. So rather than making a song that isn't boring when it's looped, you got to make sure the song doesn't become a burden, because maybe there's too many elaborate phrases and you try to reduce the accent a little if necessary. It's the same with hip hop. You know, I think a lot of people come into Mega Ran, they're like, I don't like rap, but I like what you do. And it's like, yo, it's the same. It's the same thing.
Yeah, he always says it. And I've been there like numerous times at the merch table after a show when someone's like, man, I don't like hip hop, but I love what you're doing. And Raheem is like, okay, I could just shake a hand and be like, okay, thanks. But sometimes when he has the time, it's like, let's turn this into a teachable moment, or like, let me expand your palette of what you listen to. You should also check out this, and I'm influenced by this. So if you like me, you kind of like them too, because I'm just an offshoot or have been influenced by, you know, these people too. So I love Raheem is like the king of, you know, as a student, I'm an educator now, so I love like hearing what the students say. So the term that I've heard them use is, you're the plug, you're the connect. And Raheem has been that for me on a lot of levels. Like, and for a lot of people, he's always just been that bridge of getting, like you said, the uninitiated, the people, you know, and like bridging them to the stuff that they may like. And personally for me, I have to say, and I will always say this too, Raheem, in a lot of ways, not to keep it in a video game nerdy realm, but he kind of dropped with us doing that album, Forever Famicom, in 2010. It was like dropping the Phoenix down on my career, because at that point, my situation with Ruckus was over. We were signed from like 2005 to 2009. So, you know, I was a year removed from just being signed. I didn't have that kind of safety net anymore. But at the same time, I'm independent. So I know that a lot of stuff I do, I can profit directly from and don't have to get a split of a split when I get a friggin' ASCAP check.
Why didn't you join Rob P and Dime with the Fudge Monk on Redef Records?
Oh, I pitched to them. Like, I've been in their ear, like, about bringing Panacea over there, and they're like, Panacea, we have if you listen to their stuff, for the most part, prior to what Raw Poetic's been doing, their stuff is very much in the realm of with Damu. Even the other acts they signed, KDAF and Klaus Layer, you know, all the people kind of had that boom bap, like that Damu sound, like he's the architect of that. So, and because he is the business partner, shout out to him and Jay Noda, they have very, in their heads, like a very distinct vision of how they want their stuff to do. And I think because they saw me kind of flourishing on my own, like I kind of went into this video game realm, this nerdcore realm, and they were like, yo, well, K's cool. Then you had Jason, a Raw Poetic, who's like by himself. Maybe, you know, it was never a pity thing. It was like, yo, like, let's scoop him up. And it's cool to see how Redef is kind of expanded, because if you listen to the album that Raw Poetic and Damu did.
Got a lot to say, she just spot the way. Now we gonna lock the cage. Hold up, so many claim they gotta lock the way. Y'all all be motherfucker, turn your locks to praise. You're hot, I'm Shay, your flow, I'm a tidal wave. Of all due, opponent for the final days. Black, get your spook like an alleyway. I'm seeing in the night till I smile. They say, I don't smile from the wild, I'm the highest paid.
Would I like to be on Redef? Yes, I get it, but I also understand why I'm not on Redef. Like, I'm kind of just on my own wave. And to be honest with you, just the more I think about it, I don't know how much more music is going to be at my forefront. The thing that really has me excited now about audio in general, because I'm an audio creative, is podcasting, and which you and I have talked about.
Well, I was about to say, I know it's kind of cliche to say we only scratched the surface, but basically everything that we touched on in this episode can spiderweb into more lengthy stories. So it's almost like this this K Murdoch 2.0 is in full effect, and I'm glad I could get you on the show to document this conversation. And yo, let's take this thing over, man. Let's bring back Bits, Rhymes, and Life 2.0. You know, we got all these shows, Random Encounters, Matt Mania. Respect the conglomerate, man. Let's do this. So I'm excited.
You got your busted runs, man.
Yeah, I'm honored to have just an hour of your time, man. This was really great, man. So thanks a lot.
Thanks for letting me talk, man. I really and you know I like to talk. Now, you definitely know I like to talk, so I appreciate it.
I wish I had a studio in here so I could give you like a mug of water in between this. I mean, your throat's got to be dry. My bad.
No, I have a bottle of water. I've been taking my swigs and in between and all that stuff, man.
All good,
so
man.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you so much, Shello.
Right on, man.